CBS News Face the Nation in 60 seconds.
Say goodbye to thieves. Say hello to CUDA-CAM by Barracuda Networks, the leader in cloud security and storage solutions. CUDA-CAM is a complete cloud-hosted video surveillance solution that captures high-quality footage when motion is detected. Just plug in one or more CUDA-CAM cameras with no network or camera configuration. Video evidence is automatically encrypted and stored in the Barracuda Cloud for secure access from any web browser or mobile device. Visit CUDA-CAM.com to learn why CUDA-CAM is so easy on your wallet, yet so hard to avoid.
Today on Face the Nation, the candidates enter the final stretch of campaign 2016, and the East Coast prepares for another possible round of Hurricane Hermine. Saturday, Donald Trump went to church looking for minority votes and maybe some divine intervention to help his campaign against Hillary Clinton.
I am here today to listen to your message, and I hope my presence here will also help your voice to reach new audiences.
But after Trump's surprise trip to Mexico and a speech on immigration further muddled his message, is the outreach strategy working? We'll find out with new battleground tracker poll numbers, plus analysis of where the race stands. We'll talk with New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who heads Donald Trump's presidential transition team, and we'll check in with Arizona Republican Senator Jeff Flake to see if he's any closer to supporting the Republican presidential nominee. And as Hillary Clinton closes the books on a big month of August fundraising, we'll talk about the fallout from new revelations out of her FBI interviews about the use of a private email server while Secretary of State. Plus, former Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez talks about his new book on the George W. Bush years and weighs in on campaign 2016. It's all ahead on this Labor Day weekend on Face the Nation. Good morning and welcome to Face the Nation. I'm John Dickerson. We've got a lot to get to today, but we begin with Hermine, the storm that's caused the heavy rains, high winds, power outages, dangerous surf, and two fatalities as it moved across Florida and now up the eastern seaboard. Eric Fisher is chief meteorologist at our CBS affiliate, WBZ, in Boston. Eric?
Good morning, John. Very tricky storm we've been tracking here over these last several days. And the latest trend, a little farther to the east. That's what we saw overnight tonight. So many along the coastline will see conditions deteriorate over time as we head into overnight tonight and Monday. And tropical storm warnings are still up from the mid-Atlantic up to coastal Connecticut. Tropical storm watches in southeastern New England. And here's the latest track, staying a little farther to the east. What that means is a lot less rainfall. Really no rain except for right along the immediate coast late tonight and Monday, getting some showers. But the heaviest rain stays offshore. At the same time, it's still a very strong storm. Big wind field, and it's going to move very slowly. So as we head through Sunday and into Monday and into Tuesday, those strong winds churning up the surf, and so our main impacts are going to be still some coastal flooding, also a lot of beach erosion from the mid-Atlantic up into New England. Rain totals low, some even seeing the sun, but the beaches really taking a beating this Labor Day weekend. John?
All right, Eric Fisher, thanks so much. Turning now to the other big story this weekend, campaign 2016. Our CBS News Battleground Tracker today looks at North Carolina, where Hillary Clinton is up by 4 points over Donald Trump, 46-42%. In Pennsylvania, a state Donald Trump promises he'll win, Clinton enjoys a comfortable lead with 45%-37% for Trump. We've added Arizona and Georgia to our original 11 battleground states. So now, if we look at the race in the 13 most potentially competitive states, Hillary Clinton is up by 2 points over Donald Trump, 42-40%. The remaining voters are either undecided or supporting a third-party candidate. Joining us now from his home in Mendham, New Jersey, is Governor Chris Christie. Governor, before we get back to politics quickly on Hurricane Hermine, you've declared a state of emergency. What's the situation as you see it now?
Well, as you just heard in the forecast, John, we got some good news overnight that the storm is tracking a little further east, which will mean less water. We still expect in our three southernmost counties where we did declare a state of emergency, Cape May, Atlantic, and Ocean counties, that will still have moderate flooding starting later today into tomorrow because of the slow-moving nature of the storm. But so far, unless it makes a turn back west, which these storms always can do, unless that happens, I think that we're going to look at moderate flooding rather than a very severe impact.
All right, let's switch now to politics. You helped set up the meeting this week between Donald Trump and the Mexican president. What was the point of that meeting?
Well, listen, I think that what Donald Trump wants to show everyone is that he will be a leader for all Americans And he'll be someone who's going to reach out, even when he has some disagreements with a foreign leader, to reach out and open a dialogue. And I think the words he used at the end of that meeting were very important, that he enjoyed the meeting, that he likes President Peña Nieto, and that he thinks they can work together to help improve the economies of Mexico and the United States. All those things are very important, and I think those are things that they also stand for, which are that they're going to fight for the people of their country. I don't think anyone would expect anything less from a President Trump or a President Peña Nieto, but I think the meeting was to make sure everybody understands that this is going to be a president who will work with our allies to make sure that lives of citizens in both countries improve over the next 4 years.
So after the meeting, Donald Trump then gave a speech in Arizona in which he said, they don't know it, but they're going to pay for the wall. He was talking about Mexico. After setting up a meeting to show this part of his character and building a relationship with Mexico, why say something like that to show that he's dominating the Mexicans or would as president? How does that work? Isn't that a mixed message?
No, John, I think he was just being candid. I mean, that's one of the areas that obviously they disagree upon and are going to have to be the topic of further discussion going forward. But I think what Donald was doing was being very candid with the American people about this is one of the areas where they disagree. This is the kind of transparency you get from Donald Trump as opposed to what you get from Hillary Clinton, who hasn't had, you know, a press conference in nearly 10 months, hides, doesn't answer questions except for high-dollar donors. I mean, the fact is that Donald Trump's going to tell you exactly what he thinks. Sometimes you'll agree with it, sometimes you won't, but you'll never have to wonder. Hillary Clinton, she's the mystery woman of 2016. All we know is that she's told us she had one device, and that's why she used her private email server, John. And now we find out this week from the FBI, 13 different mobile devices and 5 different iPads, most of which are now gone.
The wall that Donald Trump was talking about, do you think that's really going to happen, that Mexico is going to pay for it?
Listen, I think that Donald Trump has negotiated some extraordinary deals over the course of time in his career, and this will be another challenging deal for him to negotiate, but I absolutely believe that's the way he sees it, and it'll be part of an overall negotiation with Mexico to improve the economies in both countries and to make sure that the lives of the people in both countries are protected from drug running and gun running and illegal immigration, which is hurting both countries, John. So, listen, I people have lost a lot of money so far in the last 16 months betting against Donald Trump.
So, because the wall is such an important part of his candidacy, you said during the primaries, this makes no sense, referring to the wall. I've met President Peña Nieto a number of times. I don't think if we present him with a bill, he's going to pay for it. So were you wrong then?
Yeah, I disagreed with Donald Trump at the time. Big shock. I was running against him, John. And so let's pull out all the quotes where people who are now supporting Hillary Clinton disagreed with her during the primary as well, so that we can be fair about this. Of course I disagreed with him because I was running against him.
But I'm saying, but do you think it's possible
people,
now?
But John, a lot of people, myself included, have lost betting against Donald Trump. And I think he's going to be a very good negotiator for the American people, not only on this issue, but on trade deals that will help improve our economy and to make the world safer and more secure.
On the question of the 11 million undocumented, there's been some confusion. And Donald Trump at one point said they would be leaving America so fast it would make your head spin. Now he's saying it's something that'll be worked out. In the way we've seen immigration talked about, that kind of softening, to use his word, usually is a prelude to not ultimately dealing with all 11 million. That's what it feels like here. Why is that not the case? Why is this not basically moving away from his position he had in the primary?
Listen, we want candidates and leaders to listen, and if they hear new information or different information that leads them to conclude different things in their positions, we want them to do that, John. We don't want people stuck in cement. Be really clear. Donald Trump is going to get rid of very early on the 2 to 3 million criminals that are here illegally in this country. That will be priority number one. And once we remove those 2 to 3 million from the country, return them to their countries of origin because of their criminal conduct, then I think what Donald Trump wants to do is take a deep breath and look at where we are in the country then and find a humane way to deal with those who remain. And so I think what he's talking about is a pause after the 2 to 3 million get put out of the country because they're committing crimes, hurting Americans, selling drugs, doing things that are illegal. Once those people get dealt with first, and I think everyone agrees on that issue, then we can deal with the remaining 8 million people. That's what Donald Trump wants to do. I think that's the humane way to deal with it. And I'm proud of the fact that he's been willing to stand up and say what he really believes on this as he's learned more about the topic.
So your point is that this is an evolution to a pause, which shows his ability to adapt to changing information.
Absolutely. And that's something that, Hillary Clinton will tell you Donald Trump can't do. But what I'll tell you about Hillary Clinton, John, is that she doesn't evolve. We don't even know if she evolves because she doesn't talk to anybody except for mega rich donors in the Hamptons and all over America. Hollywood and the Hamptons are the two places where Hillary Clinton answers questions, on shows like yours.
I hear a line of attack there that might be used in the debate. You're a part of the debate prep with Donald Trump. You also went up against him. How much does he really need to prepare for debates?
Everybody needs to prepare, John. I mean, you need to get ready. And Donald is taking that process very seriously. But in the end, there's nothing you can do in preparation that can hide the essence of who you are. The essence of who Donald Trump is an outspoken, aggressive, smart, successful businessman who's going to be a strong leader for our country. The essence of Hillary Clinton is she's a political insider who over and over again has not told the truth to the American people and who thinks there's a different set of rules that apply to her than everybody else. And so you're not going to be able to hide that no matter how many coaches she hires, John, to help her in debate prep. It's not going to change the essence of who she's been and who she is. And that's what you're going to see in the debates on September 26th.
I want to ask you about a report in The Washington Post this week about Donald Trump's foundation paying a fine to the IRS for a $25,000 donation it had given to a political committee supporting Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi in 2013. She was looking into maybe investigating Trump University, ultimately didn't. Donald Trump has said he knew better than anybody how to use the system, how to use political donations to get the system to work for him. Is that an instance of that in that situation? Gave the money, then the investigation didn't happen?
I can't believe, John, that anyone would insult Pam Bondi that way. She's an outstanding attorney general who's been reelected by the people of Florida. She's somebody who has been an outstanding law enforcement officer and continues to be. And I can't imagine that Pam Bondi would ever make decisions on that basis. But what I will tell you is we now know that Bill Clinton has taken over $16 million of taxpayer money to help to fund the Clinton Foundation, a foundation that essentially was the person and the group that was screening who would get to see the Secretary of State. If you wrote your multi-million dollar check to the Clinton Foundation, then you got a visit with the Secretary of State. There's no doubt about what was going on there, John. Same way there was no doubt that when Hillary Clinton said she had a private email server for one device so she could use one device, we now know from the FBI she had 13 devices, one of which was destroyed with a hammer by her staff. Why were they hammering her cell phone, John? I mean, you know, let's talk about the real issues of trust in this race. And the real issues of trust in this race, and I can tell you this as a former prosecutor, I'm stunned given what I saw in the FBI files that were released Friday.
All right.
That Hillary Clinton was not prosecuted.
All right, Governor Christie, we've run out of time. Thanks so much for being with us. Joining us now from Phoenix is Republican Senator Jeff Flake. Senator, Donald Trump this week visited Mexico, met with the president there, and gave a very fiery speech in your state of Arizona. At the end of the week, what do you think the net result is of those two actions?
Well, the speech in Mexico and that action, I think all of us had some hope after that he might be changing the tone and tenor of his campaign. But then when the speech was delivered in Arizona later that day, he seemed to be right back where he has been.
What's your understanding of how he's going to handle the estimated 11 million undocumented immigrants in America?
You know, that's not clear at all. Some people, as he said it was hardening. Some said softening. I say it was just confusing. There really isn't any clear indication of whether or not, for example, kids who were brought across the border when they were 2 years old, the so-called Dreamers, whether they would be forced to go back to Mexico and if there would be visa slots for them to return to the United States if they so choose later on. So it really is unclear right now.
You have been a part of the immigration discussion in Washington. You spent a lot of time on the issue. With that experience and listening to the speech that Donald Trump gave in Arizona, how do you think his immigration plan, which he plans to kick off the minute he gets in office, how would that be received in Washington? What would those early days and months of his administration be like?
Well, any serious immigration reform has to include four elements. Obviously, border security. Donald Trump has talked quite a bit about that, although just really one element, building a wall and making Mexico pay for it. That's not a very serious policy in and of itself. But then you've got to talk about interior enforcement. having an e-verify style system to allow employers to know who they're hiring. And then you've got to have a robust temporary worker program, both for skilled and unskilled labor. He's talked very little about that. And then the mechanism to deal with those who are here illegally now. And that has been just kind of muddied at best.
If you talked about the tone and tenor of his campaign, we've had this conversation, you and I, before. Since then, Donald Trump has made a bit of a pivot. He said he regretted some things. He's tried to change this position on the undocumented workers. He's also kind of layered over his view about not allowing new Muslim immigration. Has any of those moves done anything to change your thinking about him as a president?
Well, I'd like to see him stick with some of those positions for a while. The ban on Muslims, he does seem to have walked back. He's talking more about regions or visa, you know, vetting process. That seems to be better. I'm glad to see that. With regard to immigration, he pivots and then pivots right back. So it's kind of a 360-degree pivot at times. So I'd like to see a firm position that he sticks with for a while. And obviously, I'd like to see it a more realistic position in dealing with those who are here illegally now.
You know, you've said a version of that before. Given how long you've held this position, aren't you really at a point of no return in terms of ever supporting him?
Well, it becomes increasingly difficult to see that he's going to change. So I don't expect that I'll be able to support him in November. And I'd like to. He's a Republican nominee. I just don't see how I can.
And you've advised other Republican senators running, including John McCain in your state, to distance themselves from Donald Trump. John McCain, in an ad, appears to be doing that, saying he'll be a check against Hillary Clinton. Is he taking your advice?
No, I wouldn't suggest he's taking my advice, but he's doing what I think Republicans need to do. If we want the future of our party to be what it needs to be, we can't associate with this kind of message and certainly with this kind of tone and the rhetoric that's being used. Long term, I think that drives away young voters. It certainly drives away a lot of people in the minority community that we're going to need moving ahead. So I think John McCain and others are doing exactly what they need to do.
Hillary Clinton has been saying that Donald Trump is not a part of the Republican Party. She's been saying there are Republicans who are not like him. Does that actually help Republicans who are trying to win in the same year he's running as president?
It probably does for anybody to say that. For people to be reminded that this is not what the party stands for, I think is a good thing. I wish more Republicans would say that as well. But if Hillary Clinton wants to say it, I'm glad people and voters are being reminded of it anyway.
And finally, quickly, Senator, Hillary Clinton spending money in Arizona thinks it's competitive in the general election. Is that just trickery, or do you think Arizona is really up for grabs in the presidential contest?
It shouldn't be up for grabs. Mitt Romney won it by, I think, 8 points. But frankly, it is. I think that they're spending money because they have some indication that she might be in play. And unfortunately, I think that's the case.
And is that just about Hispanic voters, or is there any other part of the vote that's at play here?
No, it's not. It's not just about Hispanic voters. I've always said that independents, swing voters, and others expect the major party candidates to have serious policy proposals. And with regard to immigration, just saying that you're going to build a wall and make Mexico pay for it is not a serious policy proposal, and I think most Arizonans know that.
All right, Senator Jeff Flake, we appreciate you being with us. Thanks so much, and we'll be back in a minute.
If you're familiar with cloud computing, you probably know that Amazon Web Services offers a complete set of secure compute, storage, application, and deployment services that help companies launch and scale their IT infrastructures while lowering costs. But did you know that you're still responsible for protecting your own AWS-based assets, meaning your applications and data, from advanced cyber threats? Protect your AWS with Barracuda Network's advanced firewall solutions. Visit AWS Marketplace or barracuda.com/AWS to learn more.
Are you hiring? Do you know where to post your job to find the best candidates? Posting your job in just one place isn't enough to find quality candidates. If you want to find the perfect hire, you need to post your job on all the top job sites. And now you can. With ZipRecruiter.com, you can post your job to 100-plus job sites, including social media networks like Facebook and Twitter, all with one single click. Find candidates in any city or industry nationwide. Just post once and watch your qualified candidates roll into ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use interface. No more juggling emails or calls to your office. You can quickly screen candidates, rate them, and hire the right person fast. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by over 800,000 businesses. And right now, listeners of the show can post jobs on ZipRecruiter for free by going to ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. That's ZipRecruiter.com/free trial. One more time so you can try it for free. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/free trial.
We're back now to talk numbers. More from our CBS News Battleground Tracker poll. We're joined by CBS News Director of Elections, Anthony Salvanto. Okay, Anthony, let's walk through this slowly. 13 states, we're going to be obsessed with them on election night. They are where the race is taking place. Give us a sense of where things now stand in those 13 battleground states.
All right, so Clinton is still leading. And in that sense, the race is essentially unchanged. She's still leading among the same demographic groups that she's been winning. But, you know, you look at her numbers underneath that lead, and she's got historically high unfavorable ratings. That hasn't changed either. So some things that haven't changed aren't good news for her. You know, we haven't seen that in polling from a front runner before. And what that does is it introduces a little bit of uncertainty still in this race, because then voters say that they feel like they're settling. Like they don't really like either choice. They've picked a front runner, but they're settling for a choice rather than making an affirmative choice. And that leaves things, I think, still a little bit up in the air.
So this is not an act of joy. They're just kind of, it's a bit more grudging. So let's just recapitulate maybe for people who haven't been paying attention what the fragility is of Hillary Clinton's lead. I mean, what is it underneath that's weak about her?
Yeah, she still has persistent issues on trust, on telling the truth, and some of it stems from the email server. You know, people say in this poll that they feel like her answers to that are getting less believable over time, not more so. But to really understand this from public opinion, John, I think you have to ladder that up to the bigger picture. In polling, people consistently say, like they feel in America today, that there are two sets of rules, one for them and one for people who have special advantages. And it seems like the email server is just reminding people of what they don't like, of what they don't like about politics as usual. And then you see that, and it bleeds into some of her other numbers, where people say, like, they feel like she is running on behalf of big donors rather than trying to help them or help the country, and even more so that she's running just because she wants to help herself rather than them. And that's where it spreads out and makes her numbers weaker.
Right. Spreads out to a bigger issue than just about specific emails. Let's talk about exactly. Donald Trump's big challenges. He's been trying to fix them. What's his big challenge and how's he been trying to fix it?
Well, you know, you look at his numbers among minority voters, they are low and they haven't moved just yet. But you wonder if, too, that some of these appeals to minority voters are also a signal to those reluctant Republicans that we've seen in the polling throughout this who worry, and they tell us they worry, that his appeal is based on racial division. They don't like that. They're not as moved even by the immigration issue as well. But, you know, you see the balancing act that he has. This week, more people said that they felt his immigration policies were staying the same. But conservatives who felt like they were changing, like they were becoming easier on people in the country illegally, got a little less enthusiastic about Trump. So that's that balancing act he's got.
This is what's so interesting. So this question on immigration, it's the signature policy of Donald Trump. When Chris Christie says that he's going to take a pause about the 11 million undocumented, that would seem to be a message to those reluctant Republicans you're talking about, that Donald Trump can change his mind, that he's not doctrinaire. And yet, on the other hand, you said that there are those conservatives who've always been with him, who are always skeptical of presidents who are or candidates who are softening, who are changing their mind on that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so let's step back and look at the big picture then, the state of the map. What's it look like?
Well, for Hillary Clinton, she's leading in enough states, and we've gone through over the weeks, state by state, that she's got enough of a cushion in the states that she could even afford to drop a couple, to lose her lead in a couple, and still get elected. And we hear so much about battleground states like Ohio and Florida. She could even afford to lose them and still win if she keeps the leads in some of these other places, like in North Carolina.
And that's because Democrats start with a group of states that are traditionally voting for Democrats, so they have a bit of an advantage, and she's doing well in enough
broad states and these battleground states. So what does the path look like then for Donald Trump?
Donald Trump has more challenges, quite frankly. And it's not just numerically in that he has to pull back so many of these states. He's got to win Florida. He's got to win Ohio. Then he's got to go and get the lead back in North Carolina and in Pennsylvania. You know, his path is narrower because, as you said, Republicans don't start with as large a base of electoral votes. So he's got to pull back some of those Democratic states. And, you know, the good news for him, though, is these states are not that dissimilar. If he can change people's minds, you'd probably start to see a sequence of states start to move, not just one or two.
All right. And you've added Arizona and Georgia to the mix, which are usually Republican states. That means a bigger map maybe for Hillary Clinton. We'll see. Thanks, Anthony. We'll be seeing a lot of you this fall, and we'll continue to help inform our viewers about what's going on in the presidential race and out there in the battleground states. Joining us now is former Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. He is out with a new book. It's called True Faith and Allegiance, a story of service and sacrifice in war and peace about his life and time serving the George W. Bush administration. Welcome. I want to start with the scene where you were briefly the one administration official to be off in a secret location. Tell us first a little bit about that experience. And then you said it gave you a new appreciation for the presidency. How so?
Well, of course, every year one cabinet official is asked to stay away. During the State of the Union, in case there's a disaster and someone in the line of presidential succession is still alive to become President of the United States. In 2007, I was advised just days before the State of the Union that I would be that person. And so I spent that evening on an airplane flying around. And I remember thinking, watching President Bush give the address that evening. And I've advised President Bush through something like 50 federal and state executions, through two wars. So I've experienced a pretty big moments with him before. But sitting on that airplane, it suddenly hit me, oh my gosh, if something happened in Washington, would I and the people on that airplane be able to govern a wounded nation? President Gibbs finishes his speech. We're ordered to go head back to Andrews Air Force Base, and we land. And I really had an appreciation of the tremendous pressure and power. The opportunity to be President of the United States was really kind of special.
Yeah. Well, we're in the middle of a campaign where people are imagining the candidates stepping into that role that you stepped into for, you know, 45 minutes or however long the speech was. You've said that it takes a special kind of person to be president.
Absolutely.
What do you mean by that?
You know, looking at the president make decisions about who should go on the Supreme Court or the decision to send men and women into battle, I think it takes someone with a great deal of integrity. I think of very few jobs or vocations where integrity matters most. The American people want to know that the person, the most powerful person in the world, is constrained by the Constitution and not use that office for personal or political gain. It takes someone with wisdom. No one is born with wisdom. It comes from experience. So I think wisdom is very, very important. It also takes someone with vision, a positive vision for America, someone who can say, come with me, I can take you to a better place. I think Americans want to believe in someone who believes in them. And so, and courage. You know, the office is about decision making. I heard President Bush say this often, and you have to have the courage to make the tough decisions, because at the end of the day, you know, that's what the American people expect, is you to make the right decision, to be bold and address the problems of this country.
And so you're a Republican. Does Donald Trump have those qualities you just outlined?
Well, I'm still evaluating
it's Donald. It's been 15 months. What's to evaluate?
Well, because he shifts positions from time to time, and you know, I don't know Donald Trump. I don't think I've ever met Donald Trump. And so I think being able to know someone takes some time. And I know there are a lot of good people that I trust and know who are not supporting him. And what it tells me is that I need to study this man very, very closely. I don't think Americans should make a decision based upon the recommendation of anyone else. For example, if I today said, I don't support Donald Trump, or I do support Donald Trump, I wouldn't expect other Americans to follow my lead. I would expect them to do their own investigation, evaluation as to whether or not this is the right person for them and their families and to lead this country.
Based on those criteria you outline and that you outline in the book, True Faith and Allegiance, let me ask you another thing you said about Donald Trump's comments about Mexico, because he went and made the trip this week. Donald Trump said, just to remind people, they bring drugs, they bring crime, they're rapists. In response to that, you said you can't unring that bell. What does that mean?
Well, I mean, there are consequences to the words of when a president makes a statement. And I talk about that in the book in terms of once the president makes a statement, it's very, very difficult to walk that back. And so I think someone in the Oval Office has to be very careful about the words they say, because There are consequences, and quite frankly, there should be consequences. When the president draws a red line in the sand and says, if you go beyond that, there will be consequences, there can be no doubt in the minds of our enemies that we intend to follow up and that there will be consequences. So the words are very important from someone who sits in the Oval Office.
Let me ask you about an anecdote in the book that got a lot of attention at the time. It was March of 2004. John Ashcroft was the attorney general. You're counsel to the president. There's a scene in his hospital room where you're trying to get an extension for the warrantless wiretapping program.
Yes.
There have been different stories told about this. Director Comey, now a director of the FBI, says that you and Andy Card were there to try and, as he put it, take advantage of a very sick man.
Right.
You tell your version of the story of what happened in the hospital room trying to get that extension. How did it go as you saw it?
Well, you're right. I spent some time in the book talking about this, and I would just say that I testified under oath about what happened in that hospital room. And the Inspector General of the Department of Justice also spoke to me about what happened in that hospital room. And so I am on record, under oath, about what happened, and no one has contested my description of what happened. Listen, Andy Card and I spoke two times before entering that hospital room about our concern that he might not be competent.
The Attorney General, John Ashcroft, who
had just had surgery. And if he wasn't competent, then we were not going to ask him to do anything. We were primarily there to report on a meeting we had just had with congressional leaders about this very same program and about the dispute, and the congressional leaders telling us we believe you should go forward with the program.
Because
it is so important in protecting American lives. And, of course, the very next day we had the Madrid train bombings. It was a very dangerous time for our country, and we were trying to do what we could to ensure that we had the tools necessary to protect America.
In terms of the warrantless wiretapping and then also enhanced interrogation, which you oversaw as well.
I didn't oversee it.
But
okay, this was
you
this,
advised on it as in your capacity with the president.
Well, I was counsel to the president, but the advice came from the Department of Justice, the senior leadership of the department, and the lawyers within the administration saying, done a certain way, it would be effective and it would be lawful.
And I apologize, not an unimportant fact. But how do you feel looking back on both of those things? Both of those policies have been changed.
Mm-hmm.
In the Republican race right now, there are some, well, Donald Trump is saying, bring back waterboarding. It would be great. What do you feel about that?
I think we should only be doing those things that are absolutely necessary and effective and lawful. And the question
was that true of enhanced interrogation?
Absolutely,
techniques?
That it was effective, and we've had testimony by folks from the CIA and the FBI talking about information that we got from the program. And at the time, the Department of Justice issued an opinion that if waterboarding, for example, was done under with certain supervision. And it was only done to three people, high-level detainees, who we believed had information about a pending attack against the United States, that it would be lawful. And so this was, obviously very, very controversial. And I don't mean in this book to try to convince anyone who believes that waterboarding was torture, that it wasn't torture. I merely meant to point out that the lawyers worked very, very hard to get this right, to ensure that the CIA and the policymakers had the tools that they believed was necessary to protect this country.
But just very briefly, a parting shot question here. Your view now, if it were to come back, there's a legal pathway to bring waterboarding back, or is that closed?
Would I support it? I'd have to want to talk to the CIA folks to say, first of all, what is the threat? If, in fact, someone has information about a bomb that's about to go off in Washington, D.C. in the next half hour, and we have someone in custody that we know has information about that, even Chuck Schumer said in that kind of scenario, Senator Chuck Schumer from New York said, yes, he would authorize torture, assuming, again, I'm not suggesting that it would be torture as a legal matter, but that would be a tool that I think we should pursue under certain kind of circumstances.
All right. Alberto Gonzalez, the book is True Faith and Allegiance. Thanks very much.
Thanks, John.
We'll be right back with our panel.
In business, risks and rewards come with every decision, like moving to the cloud with Office 365. While its benefits include anywhere access and lower costs, cyber threats and user errors can quickly wipe out data and the money you save. Barracuda Essentials for Office 365 provide an added layer of security and functionality for threat protection, email migration, data recovery, and quality of service. Move securely to Office 365. Visit barracuda.com/essentials to learn more.
Joining us now for political analysis, Susan Page is USA Today's Washington Bureau Chief. Jamelle Bouie is Chief Political Correspondent for Slate Magazine, and he's a CBS News political analyst. Molly Ball covers politics for The Atlantic, And Ramesh Punuru is a senior editor at the National Review and a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute. Ramesh, I want to start with you. At the end of the week, Donald Trump has been to Mexico, met with the Mexican president. He also gave a zesty speech in Arizona in the same day. Do the calculation. Where do things stand at the end of the week with Donald Trump and immigration?
Well, I think that it is a confusing story. Today on the airwaves, Trump supporters Chris Christie on this show and Rudy Giuliani are saying he has softened on immigration. He is no longer for mass deportation, and the story is not getting through. Well, one of the reasons it's not getting through is that Trump didn't actually say that mass deportation's not on the table anymore. He simply implied it, and he did it in a speech that was all of the atmospherics of it were extremely hard line. It's a speech that actually reads differently than it looks. And I don't see how the Trump campaign expects that it is going to get credit for softening, which it clearly wants, if it won't actually come out and make that message more explicit.
Molly, I was surprised that Chris Christie used the word pause. I mean, Donald Trump during the primary said the undocumented immigrants in America will be out so fast your head will spin. That is very different than the word pause.
It is. Look, there's been a lot of attempts to muddy the water, but I really think that a decision was made when Trump gave that immigration speech, that he cannot walk back. And as Ramesh was saying, the decision was made to cast this issue in very harsh terms, to continue to depict illegal immigrants as criminals and as a danger to this country. And so whatever policy is in the fine print, and I don't think we will ever know that because he's taken all of the positions at once in a way, but the tone of that speech, I think, really closed a door for Trump with some voters who were looking for him to be more compassionate, to strike a tone more of acceptance, no matter what policy he's advocating. I think with certain Hispanic voters and certain non-Hispanic voters, there might have been an open door, and that door was closed by the decision that Trump made to give that speech.
Jamel, who are those voters that he's trying to, Donald Trump's trying to appeal to with this softening, whatever we want to call it, whether it exists or doesn't exist?
I think it's whatever percentage of voters, Republican voters, that are staying away from states like Arizona and Georgia and North Carolina. Like North Carolina, Mitt Romney won that by a slim margin in 2012, and it's pretty much a must-win state for Donald Trump. And I think that margin is mostly the result of Republican voters who are just staying away. And you have all these activated, energized Democratic voters who are sort of taking their place. So as long as Trump is losing that group, which is college-educated, which is suburban, which is predominated in states like Virginia, Colorado, is important in Pennsylvania, as long as Trump is losing that group of voters, then his path to 270 electoral votes is very narrow, if increasingly non-existent.
You know, it's interesting. If you look at most of the demographic groups, they are pretty stable from 4 years ago, and the one exception are college-educated whites.
Right.
In the exit polls in 2012, college-educated whites went Republican by 14 percentage points. And in the last Pew Research Center poll, which is a big respected poll, they went for Hillary Clinton by 14 percentage points. That is the kind of swing that I don't think we've seen before with a big group in American politics since we started polling in the
1950s. Meaning she's up by 14.
She's up by 14, whereas Barack Obama lost them by 14 points just 4 years ago. Think of what a big swing that is among college-educated whites, a huge part of the U.S. population, a huge part of the electorate in just 4 years. I was talking to political scientists this week's Alan Abramowitz at Emory, who spends a lot of time looking at these questions. We couldn't come up with another example of that kind of swing since 1952, when we started to be able to look at the demographics of presidential elections.
Well, and the gamble of the Trump campaign is that he is realigning the electorate to make up for that swing by attracting more non-college educated white voters and a lot of Democrats. But we haven't seen him do that.
Right.
As you say, all the other groups are stable.
You mentioned Abramowitz. He has a model of election returns that predicts, based on the economy, based on these variables, Trump should win, Clinton should lose. But he doesn't actually think that's going to happen because Trump has run such a different kind of campaign that has scrambled the electorate in that way.
Jamel, do you think, going back to this point that Molly was making about realigning the electorate, if that's your take, then wouldn't you not need to do the softening because you're realigning? In other words, do you see in the softening undermining this notion that there's a huge group of people out
right
there?
I mean, the softening, I think, is de facto evidence that this group of people isn't there, or if it's not large enough to make up for the voters you're losing. I think the original theory was that Trump could have this hardline message and begin to pull non-college educated whites, and specifically non-college educated white men, from Democrats, those who aren't voting, pull them into the electorate. But what's happened is basically, yeah, you have this action reactivating a bunch of these voters, but you have a reaction, too, from college-educated whites, from African-Americans, from Latinos. And the reaction is essentially overwhelming the action. And the Trump campaign is now trying to figure out how it can mitigate the reaction, but I just don't think it has time to do so at this point.
Is this, Molly, what you saw in his visit to the Detroit church? This is also a part of this effort, and where do we think that? Is it going to be successful, meaningful? Is it all about, is it about African Americans, or is it about this group of college-educated voters that we've been talking about?
If there is a political calculation, and I think that's always an if with Trump and his campaign because so much of it is so improvisational and sort of based on the gut. But if there is a calculation, it probably is much more about those white swing voters. On the other hand, you know, you see him getting 0 or 1 or 2% of the African-American vote in these polls. There may literally be nowhere to go but up for Donald Trump. And those images where he at least seems to be making contact and listening to African-Americans could give him some lift there, but it does seem to be mostly about the predominantly white portion of the electorate that looks at him and believes that he's a racist, that he's intolerant, that he's hateful, and wants to be reassured. These people want to vote for the Republican.
Right.
They want to vote for the person with the R next to his name, and that's why I think Trump still has some upside, but he needs to convince them that they can do that.
And there's some good political science that notes that part of the gender gap in presidential elections is essentially a function of white racial views, that women tend to have softer and less conservative racial views than men do. And when they see candidates who are hardline or seemingly hardline on racial issues, they react very negatively. And so George W. Bush, for example, did better than you would expect among white college-educated women, in part because his brand, as it were, was a Republican with more liberal racial views than your typical Republican.
Ramesh, let me ask you a question about how to fix this brand issue, because you can't do it in one event. And yet, when Donald Trump went to meet with the president of Mexico, the word presidential got thrown around a lot. I'm going to apply to the wisdom of the group here. What does it mean to be presidential in a campaign context? What's the real benefit of presidential?
If you look at the breakdown in that North Carolina poll from CBS, a majority of North Carolina voters don't believe that Donald Trump is ready to be commander-in-chief. That is what it means. That is, I think, the central problem of his candidacy. People dislike him, people dislike her, but they think she is ready to be commander-in-chief. They don't believe that he is. That, I think, is when we're talking about presidential, when we're talking about gravitas, changing his image, that's the key thing he has to do.
And can you do it, though, Susan, and who you've been to many of those kinds of presidential moments, but can you do it in a just standing up there and having an image? Is that good enough?
Well, I think that combined with a good performance in debates is probably good enough, because you, in fact, have an electorate that wants to vote against Hillary Clinton because they don't think she's honest and trustworthy, because they're ready for change after 8 years of a Democratic administration. But Donald Trump, at least so far, has not gotten over the hurdle of looking like you can trust him to be commander in chief. I don't think you could say there's no time left for him to do this, because despite all the disadvantages that we've talked about so far for Donald Trump, he's still within striking distance in your national poll, 2 points in your battleground states poll. That, you know, and we've got, 65 days left?
Right, right. Well, you've given us a segue to talk about Hillary Clinton. Jamel, new information about her FBI interview. The numbers are very soft. In some polls, they're coming down. What is the state of Hillary Clinton's campaign? And, I mean, it's now been several weeks that this comes up. It's a bruise that keeps getting hit.
I pretty much think at this point you can tie Hillary Clinton's fortunes in national polls to the tenor of her news coverage. When news coverage of Clinton is good or neutral, like just after the Democratic conventions, her poll numbers basically hit your 48, your 49% level, and she ends up establishing a 7 or 8 point lead over Trump. When the emails come in, when the foundation comes in, when these questions that remind people of all the things that they do not like about Hillary Clinton, that they do not like about the broader political world come in, her numbers immediately soften to 45, 44. And that's basically been the story going back to even, you know, April and May. Her lead after the convention was very similar to her lead right at that time. The difference, well, not the difference, but the same pattern happened. In April and May, you had conversations about her emails and the foundation and her speeches and Bernie's attacks, and it softened her to 44, 45. And I think it's sort of it's almost like a timing game that we'll just see come November where she is in this cycle.
Ramesh, did you take anything away from those FBI reports that is new, or it just sort of the general issue that she has on this that will be with her all the way through to November?
There's always another piece of evidence that tends to reinforce the public's view that there is a lack of transparency, a lack of honesty and forthcomingness from Hillary Clinton. And I don't think that stories about Clinton aides destroying phones with hammers is going to help her in any way. I talked to a Republican about this, a Republican strategist who said, well, at least somebody's keeping this race competitive.
And yet a big potential scandal involving Donald Trump, and I was glad you asked Chris Christie about it because I'm surprised it hasn't gotten more attention, which is that Donald Trump in 2013, his foundation made an illegal $25,000 contribution to a campaign committee associated with the Florida Attorney General, who was at that time deciding whether to pursue an investigation into Trump University. And this is the kind of thing, he's now paid a fine, which is, as the Washington Post has reported. This should be a major story, and I'm perplexed by why it hasn't gotten more attention. I think one reason is there's so much attention to her scandals and her credibility to make attacks on the front of honesty and trustworthiness are so low that it's harder to get for her to generate outrage about this potential scandal involving him.
Well, and also it's a good news cycle for the third party candidates, I'd say.
Right. Donald Trump has also boasted about being able to do precisely that, give donations to get what he wants. I mean, he hasn't been shy about this. He hasn't spoken directly to that thing, but he has said that's why the system's so corrupt, because I was a master at playing it. Yeah. Molly, let me ask you about on Hillary Clinton. When she speaks, is that good for her campaign or bad, no matter what the topic?
I think it depends. I don't think it is the case that every time she opens her mouth, she makes things worse. And I wish she would hold a press conference. I think that whether or not she got herself into further trouble with her answers to questions, it would be refreshing to see her facing the press and answering questions. And, you know, she's playing a very conventional campaign strategy where you spend your August fundraising and then you assume that the campaign engages in full after Labor Day. So I think it's safe to assume that we will see more of her doing public events and giving speeches after Labor Day.
Jamel, she's likely to give more policy speeches. Is that a way to beat back the criticism that she's kind of disappeared during August, right? Raised a lot of money while she disappeared. But is that a way out of the fix she faces?
I'm not entirely sure, because I think when it comes to Hillary Clinton's public perception, people kind of just think that she knows a lot, that she's very prepared with regards to policy. The things that people do not like or do not believe about Hillary Clinton, they do not like that she's secretive. They do not believe that she cares about people like them. And I'm not sure if more policy speeches will fix that latter problem. I don't know if she needs to fix the former problem. Bill Clinton never, ever really quite fixed the former problem about his trustworthiness, but he was able to convince people that he cared about them. And I think that's Clinton's challenge going forward.
And it may be impossible to fix the first. The cares about you, she could, presumably, if she gave good enough speeches about solutions, that might work. That's it for us. Thank you all very much. We turn now for a moment from the negativity of our presidential race to an event that has brought multitudes together in celebration. At the Vatican this morning, Mother Teresa was declared a saint at a mass for 120,000 people in St. Peter's Square. Pope Francis praised the Albanian-born nun who died 19 years ago for dedicating her life to serving the poorest of the poor in Indian slums, calling on world leaders to end the crimes of poverty they themselves created. St. Teresa stood just 5 feet tall, but as a voice for the poor who often go unseen, she made an impact that could be seen across the world. That's it for us today. Thanks for watching. Join us next week when we'll have CIA Director John Brennan. For Face the Nation, I'm John Dickerson. Enjoy your Labor Day. Today's guests were Governor Chris Christie, Senator Jeff Flake, and former Attorney General Alberto Gonzalez. The executive producer of Face the Nation is Mary Hager. The senior producer is Jill Jackson. This broadcast was directed by Brian Nailsnick. Face the Nation originates from CBS News in Washington. For more Face the Nation, we're online at facethenation.com, and you can follow Face the Nation, John Dickerson, and CBS Radio News on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. Face the Nation is also rebroadcast on our digital network, CBSN, at 2 and 6 p.m. Eastern, every Sunday.